Sorry, Jeffrey, you're on with James.
Hey, James. Jeffrey Wells speaking. Hollywood Elsewhere. How are you?
Hey, Jeffrey. Good. How are you doing?
Pretty good. So I saw Coherence twice. I saw it.
Oh my God! Is that a good sign?
No, that's absolutely a good sign. I saw it twice within a couple of weeks. The first time was I was down in Tijuana having some dental work done because I don't have dental insurance, and I was I watched it on a streaming on my MacBook Air, and it was really, really. I think it got to me more because I was alone in a motel room, and I wasn't in my home country, and there was something about that film, obviously, that unnerves and gets to you in a very subliminal way that I thought was really exceptional. And then I saw it at the premiere in Los Angeles at the Los Feliz Theater.
Oh, okay, the night that I was there?
Well, I didn't see you there, but I came in. I didn't make it for the Q&A, but I saw, your lead actress. Forgotten her name. Sorry, it's not coming to me.
Emily.
And she was hanging out outside, and I guess you were there, but I didn't see you. I didn't. Were you hanging out outside also?
Yeah. Well, did you come to the 7:30 show?
No, that's what I couldn't get to. I'm sorry. I didn't get there until the second show, but I was there for time to catch
you. Gotcha.
Hanging out outside, so, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, the earlier show was packed. It was a great crowd.
Right.
But the second one had a few people, I guess.
Right. So that is Emily Baldoni, is it Emily Foxler? I heard she changed her name because she got married. Did she do that, or what's her last name now? Hello? We've got a bad connection here. Okay. Well, we can, what do you want me to do? You want me to try calling you back or something?
Yeah, is that better?
I heard the second half of that last sentence.
Hold on just a second. Pull over right now. I'm going to pull over. I'm being driven.
Ah, that's it. You're driving and you're on a cell, so, okay.
That's it. Hold on. Driver, can you...
And you have kids in the car.
I do. We're trying to remove them right now so I can have some peace and quiet.
Yeah, how many kids do you have? Are they your kids?
I have one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Boy,
yeah,
girl?
We're removing them right now. We should park the car. Take them out of the car.
Are you moving or something? Is that what's going on?
No, we're parked and we're taking out the kid right now.
Okay,
we're all good.
Okay. The home that the film was shot in was, of course, your home, and that is, I gathered that was somewhere in the South Bay, maybe Palo Alto in that vicinity, something like that?
It's supposed to be set up there, yeah. It's actually shot near Pasadena.
That's where your home is?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I thought you actually lived up north somewhere.
I don't. But it is set up there. It's supposed to be, you know,
right.
Sort of Silicon Valley crowd and,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Yuppies,
yeah.
Jobs.
Now, you mentioned my first reaction after, I'll just recount what I just said, which is that it got to me, it really, really got to me because I was alone in a motel room. And I felt quite unnerved by the film in a more profound way than I've felt from any similar type of experiment. It got to me, as I'm sure you no doubt intended, in a Twilight Zone-ish way. And I was thinking particularly, when I saw it, of Mirror Image, the character Vera Miles, Martin Milner in the bus station. You know that one?
I don't know that one, but everybody tells me I need to see it, so I can't wait.
Okay. Well, were you thinking of a particular Twilight Zone episode, or what was coming to you?
No, we just used Twilight Zone as proof to us that you could have something set in a mundane location, in a confined location,
right,
and yet have this cosmically amazing sounds from our youth that seemed very limited in scope and yet blew our minds.
Yeah.
So that was really why Twilight Zone was important to us. And since then, you know, went back and watched Monsters Are Due on Maple Street.
That was another one. Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, exactly, right.
Yeah, and I'm sure that I saw that one as a kid.
Yeah.
And we definitely were, you know, alluding to certain things, especially at the beginning. It's the setup is so similar. The power goes out. There's a comet overhead, and everybody's on edge. And,
right.
The theories start to roll. So that one, for sure, was part of the inspiration, at least.
You know, speaking of mind blowns, I mean, I'm amazed. Here it is. Your movie has already opened. You've done tons of interviews. It opened theatrically. It's now about to go on. Is it now about to start, what, VOD plus DVD? Or what's the thing that's about to happen right now?
Today. Today is the day. August 5th. Okay. Is it finally available on all sorts of platforms, video on demand.
Okay.
I'm not sure about the actual physical DVDs.
That might be later.
Do they even make those anymore?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do kids under 20 know what those are?
Some do. Physical media, man. I'll tell you, I don't care what happens. I can let DVDs go in a heartbeat, but don't ever talk about taking my Blu-rays away, man. I mean, I'm telling you.
I hear you. No kidding, right?
You know? I mean, I'm very, very pleased, I got to tell you, though. Have you, my favorite VOD for high def older films, classic films, is, believe it or not, the Walmart station. Voodoo?
Oh, you're kidding. I don't know anything about that. That sounds awesome.
It's one of the apps on the Oppo, which is like the Beamer of Blu-ray players. And they are available from other, as an app, within other players. And I was, I didn't know that they were a Walmart. I'm kind of embarrassed to acknowledge that. But the quality is just about Blu-ray quality for a lot of films, and you can just rent them, you know. So, really quite nice.
And what is the library like? Are you saying they're older films, or what?
Well, they're primarily, as you can imagine, modern and current. And if something is about to come out, I'm 99% certain that your film is now on Vudu, but I'd say it's a good 10-15% of its library. They have a pretty good library of 60s, 70s films. They have Charlie Varick, they have Witness for the Prosecution, all these interesting older films, so, you know. And it's really quite good. It's really quite snappy and sharp, and so, anyway.
That's great. I've got to look into that, because life has changed now that Blockbuster doesn't even have stores anymore.
Yeah.
You know? Looking for ways to get access.
Yeah, yeah. But the my mind is blown that you didn't even look at the Martin Milner, Vera Miles one called Mirror Image. It's the same basic idea, closer than Monsters, because someone out there might want to take my place, or is at least competing for my space, taking my suitcase. She's, I've got a ticket on this bus, and there she is, not me, that kind of thing. I mean, that's what your film is, at least playing with a threat of that. I mean, nobody actually threatens anybody until, of course, Emily does more than threaten to her opposite at the end. But you know what I'm saying. It's about the space, you know?
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of interviews with Rod Serling since I've made this film, and I realize I think our minds work almost exactly the same. The types of stories that he's drawn to, and the things that he was trying to do, it honestly felt like he was speaking in my mouth. He was using my brain was somehow connected to his. So. I think that that is a result of just having really similar brain waves.
Mm-hmm.
And so we gravitate toward the same thing, especially when you have limited resources.
Mm-hmm.
Because Rod Serling had so little money to make Twilight Zone, he had to choose stories that involved the surreal nature of identity and existence and questions of reality that did not require spaceships every time, or giant robots, or big special effects.
Right.
He was looking into questions about, you know, the human soul and our place in the universe,
right,
and the weirdness of the universe. And so that naturally led him to a type of story that either involved alternate realities or switching, you know, your brain, you're finding yourself in a different situation than you thought you were in, because those are cheap. they're amazing, but they're cheap.
Well, you're illustrating
the exact same thought process.
Yeah.
Out of this,
the less special effects, the less budget you have, the more you have to depend upon imagination and being inventive, and that's, your film is a perfect example of that. I don't think you spent too much money on it, and it gets you and stays with you right to the end. There's no lessening of tension, and there's nothing more engrossing than a film that is working without the usual candy, razzle dazzle CG stuff. It's fantastic. So. Love it.
Yeah, I love to hear that. I mean, and it all came down for us of, you know, it had to be a character story. Some of the Twilight Zones are so short that they kind of get their twist out, and then they're over, because they're only 24 minutes long.
Right.
And we realized, okay, we're going to have the twist, to that, but that's act one. And then it has to keep going. You know, you're going to have to follow a character as they try to solve it. And then what does it mean for their life?
Right.
What does it mean for their life choices?
Right.
What is their final choice going to be?
Mm-hmm.
And is it going to work or not? So it all comes down to grounding it somehow in a universal human question. And for us, that was, you know, am I living the best version of my life? And I think almost everybody can relate to that question. You think, wow, what if I would have done something different? What if I would have made that choice differently 10 years ago? Where would I be now? Would I be with my wife? Would I have a different job?
Speaking of choices,
in a different country.
When you were writing this and figuring and plotting this out, I know that you, I've read in interviews, incidentally, that you didn't divulge the entire piece to your actors, that you got them to be in the moment for this scene and then that scene, but you didn't give them the whole scheme. Is that true?
Yeah, well, we didn't give them anything. We any of the story. We only gave them character notes, but they didn't know anything about the story.
Okay.
They didn't even know who the lead actor was. You know, they didn't know. And they didn't know.
That's funny.
They didn't know how it was going to begin. Yeah, on the fifth day, because we only shot for 5 days, and on the fifth day, Emily Baldoni, I think it dawned on her. She went home and she told her boyfriend, she said, I think I'm the lead.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's funny. Did you, when you were plotting out, I was just thinking about choices. If you blend this with The Purple Rose of Cairo, which is a somewhat similar film, which asks you to, it really does, right? You know, it asks you to go into a thing that's a little hard to accept initially, but you know, once you buy into it, then you're in that realm, right?
Right. Okay.
And you also consider that the others, the other Jeffrey Wells, James Ward Burkett is out there, and I don't think there's room for two of us. This town, this world, this universe isn't big enough for the two of us. So it's either him or me, you know, and then it becomes your very existence is being threatened. That's what Emily's character determines towards the end of your film. So it becomes a matter of does one camp decide, well, we've got to get rid of these people. There's, you know, we can't exist with them competing for our space, and vice versa. So it has to be, you know, it has to be a guerrilla warfare in the suburbs. Did that idea hit you at all as a possibility?
A little bit. We knew that was always the trope. That was the assumption from any movie that deals with that type of subject, is that two of us can't survive. I don't know if that's actually true. I don't see why it has to be true. What? Maybe they just do. Maybe they're just going to live forever. But the characters in our movie definitely assume that that's what's going on. But that's because they're paranoid. That's because they're projecting their own fears on the other. And that's what the movie's about. The movie is not about the inherent evil that is out there of the others. The movie is about the potential for darkness within us. And that's why we project it onto anybody else.
You know, if I had a mirror image self who is trying to intrude upon my life, I think I would probably say, listen, this could work out, but let's just not live together or be in the same realm. But as far as you writing stuff along with what I'm writing and covering screenings, this could actually be pretty good to have two of us. So let's just not...
Exactly.
You know, I don't want to see you. I don't want you going out with my girlfriend. But this is, that's actually a pretty good... idea when you think about it, because all...
Yeah, see, there's a more rational way to approach it, exactly. But these characters don't think of that. they're too amped up, they're too paranoid, and Emily especially is not interested in coexisting with that. She wants that life.
Yeah.
She goes and she says, I don't want the life I had.
Right.
I missed out on a life that I feel like I should have had, this whole understudy story. We almost called the movie The Understudy.
Yeah.
And she goes in search of the best version of her life because she's determined to get it. She wants to wedge herself in to the life that she feels she missed out on. Mm. And that's the key to everything, is how far would you go to get the life that you feel you deserve, the life that you missed out on. And we found, the interesting thing was, we found talking to people that everybody was much more willing to do horrible things to themselves than they were to other people.
Uh-huh.
People are much harder on themselves than they are on others. And so that becomes sort of a metaphor as well, is that we're really rough on ourselves. We're in conflict with ourselves, and we're willing to do horrible things to ourselves.
You know, I got to ask you, there's one of your characters, one of the women characters in the beginning, talks about having an organic, natural concoction of various healthy organic substances that when you drink it or put it in a drink, it's kind of puts you in a nice fluttery headspace of some sort. I can remember about 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, somebody having a liquid that they had gotten. It was on the market, but I think it disappeared. And it was almost a little bit like a mescaline high, like an ecstasy high, but it was natural and it wasn't going to hurt you. And it was actually pretty pleasant.
Yeah.
Was that based upon anything?
Yeah.
You actually heard about that somewhere?
No, I just thought it would be really funny to have a character that wanted things natural and organic, but then also this dash of ketamine in the middle of it. And, ketamine is a very powerful drug that is abused at parties and can just wipe you out, cause you to have crazy dreams, and it's a horse tranquilizer. So we made up that concoction. It's illegal, but I'm selling it on my website if anybody's interested.
wait a minute. It's a tranquilizer. How could it also work as a? I see a term here. It's a dissociative psychedelic, used medicinally, but it's also an addictive psychedelic. Interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's ketamine.
Okay. And it's illegal now, right? Or no? It is illegal?
I think doctors can get it, yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right.
And veterinarians can get it.
Mm. That's
funny. I'm anti-drug, by the way. You have to put that in there for the kids. We can't be irresponsible. But I am selling it.
All right.
I'm selling it, but I don't want people to use it. I just want you to buy it.
Okay.
It's called With a Whisper. No, it's called Just a Whisper.
Just a Whisper. That's nice. That's actually a pretty nice little name, little good marketing thing.
Yeah. Yeah, because in the movie, that's what Beth says when they're saying, what, you put ketamine in it? She says, oh, it's just a whisper.
Uh-huh. There's also a senior assisted living facility called Just a Whisper.
Oh, that's nice.
Out in Minnesota.
I might move my business there someday.
Have you become a, if I were a producer, if I were looking for that, I would want to work with a Rod Serling type guy who could deliver these type of things imaginatively without even touching a threatening budget. I would definitely want to. Have you been, you know, more popular in mainstream Hollywood since this film came out? I mean, I would certainly be in touch with you. I would want to know you. I would want to work with you.
That's nice. I don't know. I mean, I definitely get a lot of meetings, but it's not like they're offering me the next Twilight Zone. People get interested. People hear about it. People watch it. And yeah, they all want to meet. And you just go to a million meetings, and there's some great people. And
actually, I would imagine the way to fuck things up with you is to produce a big Twilight Zone that costs, you know, $75 million, and then that would completely go against the whole thing we're talking about, right?
Yeah, that would ruin it. I think the key is, at least in the near future, is to stay small, stay in the zone of the same kind of audience. You know, I want to make films for that that audience that appreciates this kind of thing. You know, they're craving it, I found. I kind of toured it.
Yeah.
On the film festival circuit a little bit, and just found there's this very specific kind of audience that is so appreciative for anything that is different and outside the box and right. creatively done, and they're rooting for you. You know, they're mm-hmm. they get behind you, and that has been so wonderful.
Mm. Yeah. Your old pally Gore Verbinski, has he seen it? What's he think?
Yeah, I showed it to him a couple months ago. He had a great time. I think he responded to the performances the most just because he could really appreciate my frustration with, you know, working on these big movies where you have to plan them out so much in advance that you're not really allowing for a lot of improv and a lot of naturalistic performance. So he had a big smile on his face, like, mm-hmm. oh man, I know why you did that. Mm-hmm. I know exactly why you mm-hmm. made that movie. Mm-hmm. So that was great.
Hey, some people, when I praised your film in my initial post, said, oh yeah, well, you got to see Primer, because Primer is on the same level. Or do you know Primer? Have you seen it?
Yeah, are you telling me you haven't seen Primer?
I haven't seen Primer, even though I was admonished and told I was an asshole because I hadn't seen it. So I'm still behind the curve on that. I'm going to see it. I'm not.
You need to drop whatever you're doing right now and see Primer.
Okay.
Do not eat. Do not bathe. Go watch Primer today.
Okay. I mean, I know Shane a little bit from having met him in Sundance and. I saw the follow up, the most recent one, the one with the pigs, and that was amazing.
Yeah, I love that movie. Everybody asks me, "Do I know Shane?"
Yeah,
that I get asked that probably 15 times a day. Do you know Shane Carruth?
Uh-huh.
People say, "Oh, you know what? He's from Texas.
Yeah.
You're from Arizona. You guys like grow up together."
Right.
Yes, because Texas and Arizona are neighbors. Yes. I love that movie. It is not our main reference by any means, but I give him so much credit for making that.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
You need to watch it, Jeffrey.
Without fail, I am going to digest that film within the next 4 days. How about that?
I
know.
Is that a promise?
That's a promise.
Can you put that in writing in this interview?
Yep, that is a promise. I'll put it in writing, and I'm going to watch it on probably Vudu, if they have it. I hope they do.
And I think the title of this interview should be Interviewer Promises to Watch Primer Finally.
So, Coherence playing cards been made or sold, or is that just for the? I see these images of.
That would be great. No, those are Oscilloscope made those because it reminded them of the board game Clue.
Yeah.
which is a very accurate way of looking at the movie. It is a puzzle movie and a mystery movie, and it really does involve a lot of game pieces, you know, intentionally. There's small elements to track. And so it reminded them of a board game.
So you got something in the oven right now? Have you been writing anything? Is there some? I mean, if I were you, I'd be like, follow up quickly, because everybody, you know, you're the guy to know and work with. Have you got something going?
Yeah, I'm trying, man. I'm trying. I've been promoting this film nonstop for 6 months. So I'm writing like crazy. I've got two scripts that are almost done that I love that are in the science fiction realm that are smaller, but still, you know, elevated genre movies that the same kind of crowd would love. And one is sort of a time travel love story. And then I have another one that is cooking and looks like it might go first. You never want to say before it happens because so many projects fall apart, but it's looking really good.
Good. With your home that the film takes place in, it's in Pasadena. How long, it looks, I used to be, when I was married, we had a home that looked like yours. Mine was built around 1921, 22, somewhere in there, and had wonderful old plaster. Your home looks like it has some many, many decades, maybe 100 years old, maybe a little less. How old is it?
It was 1922, exactly.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, beautiful. Same as you. Great built-ins, just a great vibe. My wife decorated it, so that's why it looks good.
It's lovely. Really, really lovely place.
Thank you. Well, the lighting helped. You know, my DP, Nick Sadler, came in the night before and set up a couple practical lights so that we could light the whole thing just practically. We didn't have any movie lights.
Right.
And I think Nick did a great job of just making it look sort of cozy.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that I tend to like hanging with three people or four, including myself, like two couples. You know, that's my ideal social situation.
Right.
Whenever you take it up to six or eight, or particularly 10 or 12, then it becomes a strange atmosphere in which everybody, at least for the first hour or so, even sometimes beyond that, especially if it's a dinner party thing, everything that is said is presumed to be humorous in intent. It's supposed to be funny.
Right.
You have to, and you feel kind of bad manners, not considerate, to chuckle a little bit and laugh, and everything has to be funny. It's after a while, after a couple of hours of this, I want to just like stop laughing, and I want to just stop that whole thing of everything has to be funny, and I have to laugh at what you're saying, and so on. So. I would love to see a James Burkitt a party where it's not particularly about anything supernatural, but it's about just people and their what they kind of are hiding and what they're using to cover up with. And I just think I really loved the atmosphere before stuff happened. I really thought it was good, very sharp.
Yeah, it's cool to hear you say that. We're trying to find just the right level of you know, some levity, but there's some irritating people in the mix. There's definitely tension. You know, that whole dinner scene to me is about underlying conflicts. You know, they don't say what it is, but they're all in conflict with themselves. But they have this sort of gloss of, oh, it's a dinner party, and smiling and making jokes. But you know, almost everybody there is in some kind of pain.
Yeah,
and especially Emily, because you know this loss that she suffered of feeling like she missed out on her life, and then her boyfriend's sexy ex-girlfriend shows up, and she feels attacked by her, and then that the ex-girlfriend brings up the whole loss of the dance piece. So Emily is just like, for me, she's fighting for her life at the dinner table, and yet trying to make it look like it's just a totally relaxed meal.
Yeah,
and that's the fun of that scene is the layers underneath the mindless chatter.
I think that if it's going to be you to have the lead in this dance piece, and then a star comes along and they feel they have to give it the star. Any adult knows, well, if I were in their position, I'd probably go with a star. So it's not an insult, it's not a, but to out of pride refuse the understudy. You know, if Meryl Streep was younger, I don't think she would have refused it. She would have said, I'm going to do it because I love performing, and if I have a chance to perform, great. You know, I just think that she kind of fucked herself by insisting that she had to be the star or nothing. You know, even though...
She did, and the key is that it's not that she said no, she just didn't say yes. Mm. And because she took too long to think about it,
oh, yeah. Okay.
they went with somebody else. And that's Emily's problem, is that she doesn't commit, she doesn't make a decision,
right.
She hesitates.
Mm.
And because she hesitated, the decision was made for her.
Yeah.
And that decision to cast somebody else as the understudy,
okay.
You know, ended up changing the understudy's life. And Emily just, you know, she's reeling from the lack of control over her life. She can't even believe it, you know. Mm. She never said no. She just didn't say yes.
Right. All right, man. Well, this has been great. I'd love to actually see it again. In fact, I probably will. But I'm going to see, as we've already discussed, Primer first. But I will. I'm definitely going to see it again. I'm going to hopefully get some of my friends to finally watch this, because I was telling them, you have to watch it. You have to watch it. And none of them went to Lost Fleas. At least not that they told me about. But
Definitely get them together, because it's more fun to watch it together, because you want to debate it and argue about it afterwards.
That's true. Yeah, I can imagine. All right, man.
I hope you do, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for your time, and I hope to see the next thing happen within a year or so. Not too long, anyway.